Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
Hello, welcome to The Rest is History's London Week. So we've had, on Monday, we had a tour around Roman London. Yesterday, we were looking at two London places. And today, Dominic, we are looking at two figures who have lived in London, who are a part of the fabric of London's history. And you are kicking us off, aren't you? So who have you chosen?
Well, the thing about Londoners, Tom, is that most Londoners, or lots of Londoners, weren't born in London, were they? Is your Londoner... I don't want you to give away who your Londoner is.
No, my Londoner was definitely not born in London. Wasn't even born in Britain, Dominic.
Well, that's exciting. That is tantalising. Mm. So my London figure was actually born in Somerset, in a place called Sharpham. I don't know where Sharpham is. Have you been to Sharpham, Somerset?
No, I don't remember it.
Very small village. And he was born in 1707, and his name is Henry Fielding. So he is the son of an officer, a military officer called Colonel Edmund Fielding, who had fought under the Duke of Marlborough in the Wars of the Spanish Succession and so on. And Henry, so quite a well-off family. Henry grows up in Somerset. Disaster strikes when he is 11. His mother dies. And his father, Edmund, the military man, is generally regarded as feckless. He's charming but feckless. So extraordinarily, Henry's grandmother sues his father for custody. After the death of Henry's mum, and the grandmother wins, and Henry is taken away from his father and given to his grandmother, who sends him to Eton. Nice. So that's what happens to young Henry. And at Eton, he becomes best friends or great pals with the future Pitt the Elder, which is nice.
So he's going up in the world.
He doesn't know that Pitt the Elder is going to be Pitt the Elder. He just thinks of him as William, just some Billy Pitt or something, who loves the war game.
and his tails.
Yeah, exactly. They're having a tremendous time talking about Latin and playing obscure sports. Anyway, Henry Fielding's life takes an unexpected turn when he is about 18. He's obviously a sort of rambunctious young man. He has become infatuated with his cousin, who's called Sarah. And one day, when she's on her way to church, he tries to kidnap her and run off with her. And Sarah's family are outraged by this behavior, so Henry has to flee abroad for a time to escape prosecution. So that sort of tells you something a bit about his personality. So to give you a sense of him, Tom, he's a huge man. He's more than 6 feet tall, which is very tall by the standards of the early 18th century. One of his friends says, quote, he was not a handsome man. So, you can draw your own conclusions. Mm-hmm. He's said to have joked with his friends about his nose and his chin. So
what was the joke?
I think the joke was they were quite large. They're over large. But he's a very warm and sociable sort of man.
Well, he's a very funny man as well, isn't he?
Yeah, one of his friends said of him, he had more wit and humour than Swift, Pope and the other wits of his time put together.
Because did he end up writing a very famous novel that then became...
He did. I'm going to come to that. Because he's a man of great appetites and passions. So he loves food, he loves drink, he loves snuff. He's a great snuff addict. And he loves the pleasures of the bedroom. So he's lusty. He's a lusty 18th century fellow. And he starts off, he decides he wants to be a writer. So he comes to London. He's sort of hanging around London with other wits and coffee house people and stuff.
Grub Street.
Exactly. He writes plays which satirize Walpole, who's the first prime minister. The sort of
Jonathan Wilde, isn't it? Is that right?
Exactly. The big cheese of the day. So Jonathan Wilde is about a thief taker, isn't it? Jonathan Wilde is a kind of metaphor for Walpole in this. So his plays are sort of censored and he's slightly frowned upon. He moves into books because he writes the big book of the day is a book called Pamela, a sort of epistolary novel. Mm-hmm. One of the first, if not the first, novels in English. And
Samuel Richardson.
And it's very improving, sort of morally serious kind of book, as all Richardson's books are. So Henry Fielding writes a spoof of it, a parody called Shamala, and that's very successful. So he writes more books.
So he does one about supposedly her cousin, doesn't he?
Joseph Andrews.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then at the end, so that's in the 1740s, and then at the end of the decade ends with him writing his masterpiece, Tom Jones. So Tom Jones is, for people who don't know, that is a book that everybody should read. An absolutely uproarious, rambunctious, really fun book, brilliantly written, sort of picaresque. Tom Jones has all these adventures across
the
country.
Who's the squire? Who's very
Squire
much like
Weston.
You. Squire Weston. Very like you.
Like me?
Yeah. Kind of
grumpy, miserable.
Yeah, but he's a kind of honest man, lives in the country, has no time for London.
Yeah, that's right.
Writes so columns for the Daily Mail, all that kind of stuff.
I thought of myself as Tom Jones in that.
I'm afraid not, Dominic. I'm afraid not. And then there's a sinister schoolmaster, isn't there, called Thwackum?
That's it, exactly, yes. I think it is Mr. Thwackum, isn't it? Tom Jones is always, he basically travels across the country, falling in and out of people's beds, leaping out of the windows of inns.
Eating oranges.
Yeah.
In a lascivious way.
Exactly. Yeah. And this was made into a film in the 1960s, 1963, I think, with Albert Finney. Absolutely tremendous sort of 60s film. Looks quite dated now because it uses all sort of 60s gimmicks and quirks.
Technicolor. But,
yeah. Anyway, he goes into the law. So he's involved with the law and he's, and this comes about because he's a fanatical anti-Jacobite. So he's a very sort of staunch Anglican.
Supporting the Hanoverians.
So when you have the 45, the sort of Bonnie Prince Charlie uprising, he writes loads of stuff for the government saying, Bonnie Prince Charlie's a terrible fellow. Hurrah for the Hanoverians, all this. And as a result of this, he is appointed as basically London's chief magistrate. And this is really his claim to fame, specifically as a Londoner. Because London in the 18th century has expanded colossally. So loads of sort of what were previously sort of the rural fringes of London have been filled in and are now absolutely teeming with people, with crime, with poverty. So places like Covent Garden is the sort of classic example.
And Gin actually, Lane is the Hogarth.
Yeah, so the Gin Lane, if you think of Hogarth's cartoons, are sort of people falling out of windows and, you know,
dropping their babies down. Babies,
exactly, on the streets. The sort of fear of the London mob and all of that sort of stuff. So this is partly what Fielding's job is to deal with. And one reason that it's been very difficult to deal with it is London obviously has no police force. So it basically has a system of volunteer constables who are completely useless. But it also has a system of, you mentioned Jonathan Wild, of thief takers. So the thief takers are utterly corrupt. They basically will solve, if you're the victim of petty crime, the thief takers will solve it for a fee. So you pay them basically to...
Like bounty hunters.
They are, exactly. But they're in league often. I mean, often some of the big thief takers, I mean, they're actually the heads of criminal gangs themselves.
Yeah.
So they basically profit in every conceivable way. They rob you and then they charge you to get your stuff back. It's intensely corrupt.
Yeah.
So Henry Fielding, his office, the magistrate's court, he's become the chief magistrate, and his office is in Bow Street, at number 4 Bow Street, which is in the Bedford Estate near Covent Garden. So this is quite a notorious red light district in the mid-18th century. He's in the heart of it, and he wants to sort of sort it out. Now, he's very forward-thinking, because at the beginning of the 1750s, he writes a sort of blueprint called A Proposal for Making an Effectual Provision for the Poor. And he says, basically, what we should do is we should get thousands of poor Londoners. We should build a massive workhouse for them. And that sounds grim, but wait for it, in which they'll be decently housed. We'll teach them a trade. They'll get wages. They'll pay them a little bit as they learn the trade. And they'll be, you know, have lessons and they'll have religious services and all this stuff. And they'll basically be rehabilitated. And then we'll turn them out of the workhouse as useful citizens. So it's basically a sort of Scandinavian prison. and obviously nobody listens. People think it's absolutely demented. So
kind of woke tosh.
Woke tosh. So he's that's ignored. But what is not ignored is his idea for police. So he has this idea of employing, instead of people employing kind of private thief takers, he, as the magistrate, will employ a team of 6 highly skilled, trained men, crack men, who will work for him. He will send them out to raid robbers and highwaymen, to raid gaming houses, to sort of charge off and apprehend villains and get back people's property. So the six of them at first, they are each given handcuffs, a pistol, and a stick. They are given a guinea a week, and basically if they catch criminals, they get commission on top of that, and they're answerable to him.
Does that not encourage them to, you know, fabricate evidence, say, or...?
No, they're absolutely unimpeachable, Tom. That is woke tosh coming from you. That's shocking.
Okay, I'm sorry to cast questions on the Bay Street Rummers.
Yeah, why do you hate Britain, Tom?
I'm sorry.
No, maybe it does. I haven't come across it, but maybe if there are Bow Street Runners aficionados out there who know...
Bow Street Runner truthers.
Yes, exactly. So there's only six of them, but this is a tremendous innovation. I mean, I know six doesn't sound like many, but it does expand over time.
And what's the population of London at this point? About a million?
Yeah. So, I mean, how many do you need?
So it's kind of like Marvel Comics.
Well, within 50 years or so, Tom, there are 68 of them. I mean, come on. Yeah. I mean, that's loads.
So what's the difference between them and what Peel does?
That's a very good question. I think they're just much less regulated. They're quite informal. They're answerable to the magistrate.
And they don't wear those kind of blue top hats.
They don't have any uniform at first. They wear their own clothes. So they're plain clothes. But the other thing that's really interesting is that... his brother, so he has a brother called John, and John was blinded at the age of 19 in a naval accident, the details of which he never divulged to the public. Mm. So he's been blinded mysteriously on a ship. We don't know why. And John has the idea. He says, why don't we issue a sort of gazette, a police gazette, that will have descriptions of criminals? And this is the first time they do it. So they basically send out, you know, wanted Tom Holland looks
wearing
like,
a wig.
Right.
You can't miss him.
Yeah. All 1870 men look the same. So,
yeah.
So do you want to know what this was called? It was called the Quarterly Pursuit, the name of this gazette. But they decided that was a terrible name. So they renamed it, I think. I don't know whether this is a worse name or a better name. They renamed it the Public Hue and Cry.
That's a great name.
So the Public Hue and Cry, you would buy that. It would have all the details about the latest thefts.
Horrible murders,
wanted suspects.
Highwaymen.
Yeah. So,
do you know, how come no one has made a kind of...
a rollicking series? You shouldn't have given it away, Tom, because we now can't...
Yeah, we can. We can.
Do you think?
Yes. We could do the Rest Is History productions.
Yeah. So if you're listening, if you're some sort of TV producer with horrible glasses...
They don't have to wear horrible glasses.
But they do, though. They do.
No, they don't.
We both know that they do.
I think you're showing your age. I don't think they wear horrible glasses anymore.
Don't they?
No. You've been stuck in the Cotswolds too long.
What do they wear?
They don't wear glasses. They wear contact lenses.
What
Dominic is saying is that...
It's ours. We own this. We own this franchise.
If you are listening and you're maybe working for Netflix, you've got an enormous amount of cash and you would like to commission us to produce the Public Hue and Cry, a scintillating tale of crime and detection in 18th century London, you can just email us or something.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do, Tom. I'm going to give away the end of season one. So at the end of season one, so Henry Fielding, who's been the star of the first season, you know, there's been a few flashbacks to him trying to kidnap the heiress, to him being witty, to his early life. Sometimes he talks about Tom Jones in kind of, you know, the more reflective scenes. But towards the end of season one, tragically, as we reach the early 1750s, so he hasn't actually been magistrate that long, but the Bow Street Runners are dashing, you know, all six of them around the metropolis. Henry Fielding gets dropsy. This is awful. So dropsy is apparently a cirrhosis of the liver. According to the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, it says his skin was jaundiced, his body emaciated, his abdomen grotesquely bloated with water that had to be tapped at frequent intervals. So I think with Netflix...
That'd be a shocking development.
It would be.
But it would provide great scope for a good actor.
A very good actor. Yeah, Liam Neeson.
Yes. He'd look good with dropsy.
He would. So
he'd act it well.
So do you know what he does when he gets dropsy and he knows that the game is up?
He doesn't get cured.
He doesn't get cured. I'm giving away the end.
He goes to Portugal, doesn't he?
He does. He goes to Portugal. So the final scenes, there's location filming involved.
So that's the Christmas special.
Yes, it is. Yeah. So he ends up in Portugal and he dies in Lisbon in 1754. And he's buried there in the English cemetery in Lisbon. So later, I mean, this probably won't be in the Netflix series. In a Kingsley Amis novel, the plot slightly revolves around the fact that the character, a thinly veiled version of Kingsley Amis, has been invited to Lisbon to deliver some sort of Henry Fielding lecture. But in season two, Tom, we move to John Fielding, his brother, who you may remember.
The blind one.
Yes, whose nickname is the Blind Beak.
The series writes itself.
And he has a superpower. He's also a tremendous man. He founds an asylum for orphan girls in Lambeth, in your neck of the woods, South London. Yeah. And he ends up being knighted for it. So he's an absolutely tremendous fellow. But his power is that although he's blind, he can recognize 3,000 criminals by the sound
by the sound of their voice.
By the sound of their voices.
That's amazing. That is a superpower.
Because in my mind, rather like 18th century Londoners all looking the same, they all sound the same.
Yeah, they do. Yeah. Well, how do they sound? How do you think they sound?
Oh, Mr. Fielding. I don't know.
Oh, bless you.
That's Victorian.
A Bow Street runner.
Oh, the runners are after me, Tom. The Bow Street runners.
Hue and cry.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is going to be a great series. So season one is Public Hue and Cry. And then the series, season two, is The Blind Beak.
Blind Beak, yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's brilliant.
I think future series, well, there's two seasons in it, definitely.
Yeah.
There's Henry Fielding, then there's The Blind Beak. I think, I don't know, do we
well,
need
we don't
to...
have to be chained to what actually happened.
No.
I mean maybe... it's kind of Peaky Blinders, was it?
Exactly. So I think by the time you get to season three, it's a generational change. Charles James Fox is maybe a character because he'd be solving crimes with Pitt the Younger.
That'd be great, wouldn't it? Yeah.
I mean, the 18th century is really, it's absent from our screen. Dr. Johnson is solving.
Dr. Johnson solving crimes.
You know what it is, Tom? We've had a previous episode about Dr. Johnson dealing with ghosts.
Yes.
Remember?
So he's ghost busting.
Ghost busting.
Yeah.
Fabulous. Johnson and Boswell are ghost busting. I mean, there's so much to play with.
So much to play with.
It's unbelievable. We haven't had an offer.
So TV producers, please don't be offended by Dominic characterizing you as wearing ludicrous glasses. Scrub that. Focus on the gold that is this rich scene of historical.
You make this series, you can buy enough glasses to last you a lifetime.
Okay. That's brilliant, Dominic. Great choice. Let's go to a break.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. So this probably, Tom, will be one of the last Rest is History episodes we record, because after this, we will be leaving podcasting to concentrate on the blind week. But in the meantime, to leave listeners, leave them something to remember us by telling us about your top Londoner.
Well, so I may have mentioned this before, Dominic. I live in Brixton,
yeah,
in South London. So I wanted to choose someone who lives in Brixton. So Brixton's actually had quite a lot of famous people who've lived in it. So David Bowie, of course.
Yep.
John Major.
Two very different men.
Ken Livingstone.
Yeah.
Clive Dunn, who was Corporal Jones in Dad's Army.
Yeah, so, mean nothing. Most of these people mean absolutely nothing to our overseas listeners.
Well, David Bowie would. I'm sure most people have heard John Major.
And everyone's heard of John
Major. Prime Minister, yeah.
Top Brixton-born Prime Minister.
So in London, there's this thing where you have blue plaques, which mark the houses of where famous people lived. And there are three blue plaques in Brixton. So one of them is Dan Leno, who's a music hall artist.
Yes, music hall.
Very famous.
Who Peter Sellers believed was communicating with him sort of
psychically,
through the ether, psychically. He would occasionally, when people would offer Peter Sellers a part, you know, do you want to play Inspector Clouseau again? He would turn and he'd mutter over his shoulder and he'd say, "What do you think, Dan? Do you think I should do it?" So Dan Leno is still with us.
And Peter Ackroyd wrote a novel.
And the Limehouse Column.
Yeah. So there's obviously a kind of faint hint of the supernatural around him.
That's exciting.
And then there's Havelock Ellis, who lived on a house at Brixton Hill, which is where I live, who was he was a sexologist.
I was just about to say he was a sexologist, but I don't know anything about him other than that word.
Well, he was a pioneering sexologist.
What did he do?
Hello, I'm a sexologist.
So, well, there's another Netflix series, Tom.
Yeah.
We're absolutely on fire today. Okay. Yeah.
So he was a pioneering sexologist. And then the third one is the man that I have chosen, who is C.L.R. James.
Oh, that's a good choice.
And C.L.R. James, well, you'd like him because he's a Marxist.
Of course. Yeah.
He's actually a Trotskyist. He's a big fan of Trotsky. But the reason I like him is that he obsessed about cricket and wrote a book called Beyond the Boundary, which is widely held to be not just the best book on cricket, but one of the best books on sport ever written. And he ended up in Brixton. He lived there for the last years of his life, but he was actually born in Trinidad. He lived most of his life outside London. But I don't think that that makes him any less legitimate as a choice for a Londoner, because, well, you were talking about with Fielding coming from Somerset.
Yeah,
London has always been a place that attracts people who live outside London. And actually, you know, for most of London's history, it was that inevitably fueled its growth, because more people would die. You know, it was such a kind of lethal place that you needed people to arrive to keep the population stable, let alone grow. That wasn't the case, obviously, by the 20th century. But London, I guess, for people growing up in the Caribbean, I mean, as we know from the Windrush, people and lots of people coming to London from the Caribbean, they'd be processed in Clapham, and Brixton was the nearest area to Clapham where there was affordable housing.
Yeah, because Brixton was slightly run down, wasn't it? Down a hill, and that's why cheap housing. So that's why in the years after the Second World War,
so Brixton was a place that was associated with music hall, and that's why Dan Leno lived there, and that's actually why John Major's father lived there, because John Major's father lived in Brixton. And because they were actors, musicians, all that kind of stuff, they tended to live in fairly grotty housing because they didn't get much money. And so that's why people from the Caribbean were able to move in there.
So John Major has a history of cricket.
So he does. It's very good.
And there's also, he's also written a history of the music hall. And at the beginning of his history of the music hall, there's a bit where his dad is. So John Major's father was quite old when he had him. And John Major's describing his father in sort of post-war Britain, I don't know, in the 50s, 60s or something. He's dying basically in some boarding house, in some upstairs room in a boarding house. And John Major says, this succession of very old and very strange people trooping up the stairs. And they were all people who had been acrobats, conjurers and stuff in the 1890s or something, coming up to say their farewells to John Major's father. Extraordinary scene.
Well, it's Brixton's still got that, you know, it's still a place full of clubs and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's still very much an entertainment centre. But James is actually born quite a long time before people start coming, before the Wind Rush, before people start coming to London from the Caribbean. So he's born in 1901 in Trinidad. He is kind of lower middle class, but very, very bright. So he wins a scholarship to Queen's Royal College, which is a very good school. He's highly intellectual, but he's also very, very good at sport. So he actually holds the record for the high jump in Trinidad, I think.
To this day?
Two or three years. But I mean, he is a record breaker. But cricket is his main sport, absolutely loves it. And he's almost good enough to kind of break into first-class cricket, but not quite. But he's very good friends with a cricketer who is a man called Leary Constantine, who great West Indies cricketer, and who gets an offer to go and play in the Lancashire Leagues. And the Lancashire Leagues are kind of very, very tough cricket, professional. So he goes to live in a place called Nelson in Lancashire, and James goes with him. And James, by this point, is very, 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 very into Marxism, very into cricket. So he sets up as a cricket correspondent stroke Marxist,
right,
which is, you know, there haven't been many of those. So he takes a lot of boxes. So he covers cricket in the summer and he hangs out with Marxist circles, Trotskyite circles. And he ends up writing a book that's still very, very famous, incredibly readable, on the Blackjack, called The Black Jacobins.
So that's about Toussaint Louverture, isn't it?
Yeah, and Haiti and the revolution in Haiti.
And that's sort of the definitive, or for decades, it was the absolutely definitive account of the Haitian Revolution and of the sort of, that Toussaint Louverture and that all that sort of stuff.
It's a brilliant work of scholarship. It obviously comes from a position of, it has a kind of real moral force, kind of real blaze of intellectual fire to it. But it's just incredibly readable, readable. And actually, James had written a play on the same theme, in which Paul Robeson was in it. Paul Robeson starred.
Oh, so I didn't know that.
So it was a theme he was very interested in for obvious reasons. And then in 1938, he leaves Britain. He goes on a kind of speaking tour around the United States. And while he's in the United States, he pops over the border to Mexico, where he meets Trotsky. So he hangs out with Trotsky. And he also meets Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo. So he's kind of hanging out in these circles.
He's surely not talking to them about cricket.
Well, I always wondered, did he talk to Trotsky about cricket? I mean, it's such a kind of tantalising idea.
You should write a play about it or something.
That'd be good, wouldn't it? Kind of Tom Stoppard type play.
Or indeed a Netflix serial.
No, I think it's more kind of Stoppard play at the National.
It is. It's at the Royal Court.
Diego Rivera, Frida Kahlo, Trotsky and C.L.R. James, and it's all themed around cricket. That'd be good. Anyway, so he's in America, but he is obviously not the kind of guy that in post-war America the authorities are particularly keen on.
Yeah.
And so they manage to expel him on a charge that he's kind of, visa problems, that kind of thing. So James, he comes back to London. Then he goes to Trinidad, gets back home, and that's where he writes Beyond a Boundary. His great masterpiece.
So Beyond the Boundary, which I've never read. Tell me what's so great about Beyond the Boundary. Because it is seen as one of the absolutely great books about sport.
So it's a book about cricket, but it has the theme, what do they of cricket know who only cricket know?
Yeah.
So it is also very much about the relationship of the Caribbean to Britain. It's about the way that empire works. It's essentially, I mean, it's one of the great works of post-colonial literature. And James is to Britain what Frantz Fanon is to France. I remember when I read it when I was kind of 15 or something and was terribly struck about how Marxist it was and how edgy and daring. Then I read it again a few years ago, and what struck me was how incredibly conservative it is, actually, especially compared to Fanon. I mean, he's all, you know, Fanon is still seems unbelievably radical, whereas James is actually, it's all about W.G. Grace and how much he loves Trollope and things like that. Right. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, James was a genuine, you know, he was a genuinely radical. He was a Trotskyite. Of course he was. One of the things I think that makes Beyond the Boundary great as a work of literature is that it's not just agitprop. There's a real tension there.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much about the British Empire that he hates, but he also kind of loves it. He loves cricket.
Well, he loves the cricket.
He loves the great literature. Yeah. And he loves England. And he is the one who really enshrines Grace as a distinctively Victorian hero, one who's idolized by the Victorians, but who also challenges a lot about what we would think conventionally the Victorian age is about. So it's a very, very rich book, very complex book, very, very subtle book, and very fascinating as a self-portrait as well. Because James is not a modest man, fair to say. I mean, he has a very, very kind of robust sense of his own worth. And that's also part of the kind of the drama of what he's writing about. And he writes about Constantine as well, because Constantine goes on to become, he serves in the British government during the war. He gets a peerage. I think he becomes he's the first black peer. So James is, you know, I mean, he's at the heart of quite seismic events.
Yeah. And so James, is he in Brixton at this point when he's...
No. So he's in Trinidad, but he gets expelled. In fact, briefly, he gets imprisoned and then he gets expelled. So he comes back to London. Now, where's he going to go? So by this point, Brixton has become the kind of the capital of Black Britain. And one of the guys who is kind of the leading figure in kind of intellectual circles in Brixton is C.L.R. James's nephew, who's a man I'm sure you've heard of, Darcus Howe.
Of course, Darcus Howe.
Very, very kind of impressive man. And he was still, when I moved to Brixton, you'd see him occasionally on the tube. He was very impressive looking man and kind of incredible baritone voice, and very, very smart. And he got his uncle to come and live in Brixton. And Darcus Howe is in Brixton because he is the editor of a magazine called Race Today, which had been founded in the 70s. And I think originally it had been in Notting Hill and originally had been very much focused on decolonization in Africa. So particularly concerned with apartheid in South Africa and things like that. But then increasingly through the 70s had become interested in the way that immigrants from the Commonwealth in Britain, so not just from the Caribbean, but from India and Pakistan and so on, how they were settling into Britain and what their relationship to Britain should be and could be.
Yeah.
And Darcus Howe becomes the editor of this magazine, and he moves it to Brixton, and he moves it to 165 Railton Road. And Railton Road, in the 1981 riots, which erupt, black people in Brixton against the police.
Yeah.
And it's the totemic riot of 1981. The whole of Brixton goes up in flames.
Front line, isn't it?
And Railton Road is called the front line. Yes. So it's the kind of the center of the rioting. So 165 Railton Road, it's a potent place for a magazine devoted to issues of race and questioning the fabrics of the British state and all that kind of stuff. And C.L.R. James comes and he loves it. He gives a lecture in Brixton just after the riots. And he finds it an exciting place to be. And so he says, could he stay? You know, he's looking for somewhere to live. And so he moves in.
He's in his 80s at this point.
He moves into the very small flat directly above the offices of Race Today on Railton Road. And so that's where he stays.
For the rest of the 80s? Because he died at the end of the 80s, didn't he?
He dies at the end of the 80s.
89,
And so I walk past it regularly, and I look up and I see the name of this great man up there, and it's fantastic. But the other reason I just wanted to mention him was that I think that there is also something rather wistful about it, certainly for me, because I moved to Brixton in 92, and the year before that I went to the Oval to see the West Indies against England, and this was the famous match where Botham failed to get his leg over, precipitated Brian Johnson and Jonathan Agnew, they kind of corpsed. And that was the match where Viv Richards, the great West Indies batsman, played, who actually had a kind of a bearing and a sense of dignity, rather like Darcus Howe, actually. And great bowlers like Courtney Walsh, Curtly Ambrose. So it was a very, very powerful team. England actually won that match, but which maybe served as a kind of signal that West Indies cricket was West Indies had been the great power in cricket throughout the 80s. And perhaps this was a kind of a presentiment of the fact that cricket in the Caribbean was about to go into decline. But it was, the Oval was absolutely heaving with people who'd come up from Brixton. It was a kind of, I should think about half England supporters, half West Indies supporters. It was a really, really kind of exciting, thrilling, pollulating sporting occasion. And it made me think Brixton might be a kind of great place to live because, you know, loads of cricket fans. So we moved there the next year. But since then, cricket in the Caribbean has really gone into decline. And definitely cricket in Brixton is a dead thing now. You know, it's not really followed at all, partly because the only cricket ground in the whole of Lambeth, the borough of Lambeth, which Brixton is in, is the Oval. You know, there's no other cricket ground, and the facilities are terrible. There are cricket nets in Brockwell Park, which are in a terrible state of disrepair. There are no facilities. I mean, it's not completely dead. So you've got Ebony Rainford Brent, who's a from Brixton, who played in the England women's team. So she's kind of very prominent voice in contemporary English cricket. But aside from that, it's really faded. And so when I see C.L.R. James's name on that blue plaque, it does make me slightly sad and wistful as well. So that's why I chose him.
Okay. Well, you've been listening to The Rest is Cricket with
yeah, sorry about that.
No, Tom, that's a good choice because C.L.R. James is absolutely the fact that he's not born in London and he comes as an immigrant, as a Caribbean immigrant, is part of a wider story, isn't it? But also,
yeah, definitely,
he
yeah.
he is probably the Titanic figure in that sort of tradition of, it's a tradition of kind of post-colonial writing, but it's also that very, very, I mean, the contrast with Fanon, a French writer or a French influenced writer probably wouldn't look to wrap it around the subject of cricket, would they?
Pétanque.
They would start with some, well, they wouldn't Ooh. Do a pétanque. They would do it with a series of abstract nouns about liberty or something.
Fanon is French in the way that C.L.R. James is British.
Yeah.
I mean, they both absolutely bear the stamp of the empires into which they were born.
Yeah.
But I think that James's relationship to British culture is much more conflicted than Fanon's was, I think.
Right. Okay. So we'll definitely be back tomorrow with another podcast about a walk, because we've done the walk, haven't we? It was a walk around Smithfield and about the history of kind of medieval, early modern London. Very exciting walk that we did. At the point at which we were doing that walk, my new shoes, which were inappropriate for the walk because I was going to a function
Blood
afterwards.
Blood was spurting out through the leather.
I was in absolute agony. So as Tom
and
was,
I say, come on.
Yeah. You'll hear Tom talking a lot and you won't hear anything from me but the odd kind of muffled groan. Now.
But actually, Dominic, you mentioned Dr. Johnson investigating ghosts. We have the Cock Lane ghost, so we go past.
We will be talking about ghosts tomorrow, yes. Now, there may be a podcast on Friday. If there isn't, it's because we're working on The Blind Beak with Netflix. But if that doesn't work out, we will be back on Friday with a podcast about moments from London's history. Yeah. In fact, pardon me, Tom, because our moments are so good, I almost want the Netflix series not to work out.
Well, so maybe. We'll see. Who knows?
There's a real element of tension and jeopardy in the next few days as you wait to discover whether The Rest is History has come to an end and whether The Blind Beak has got the green light.
And if it doesn't, what events we've chosen.
Yeah. And so we'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.